But if we had to follow 2017 exactly, I think it put Bitcoin at about $1.3 million in terms of percentage return. This is probably just the start of something, you know, much more longer that can probably last throughout most of 2025, if not potentially even longer into 2026. It's been unlike any other previous cycle in terms of just the market dynamics and movements of price action. But realistically, it's probably a lot more healthy and sustainable to see this kind of thing without instantly everyone seeing what's going on, etc. 21 now by Jack Mallers, who are potentially going to be accumulating, again, tens if not hundreds of thousands of Bitcoin that we may never ever see again. And at that point, just the supply and demand economics of Bitcoin changes so substantially that it's hard to really limit our upside potential. At some point, you don't want to be the one person, the one company, the one institution that isn't holding Bitcoin. And sale of buying tens of thousands of Bitcoin every single week is, of course, changing the supply and demand economics of Bitcoin. But is all of this institutional investment, interest, nation state buying good for Bitcoin fundamentally?
Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Matt Crosby in the house, who's the brains behind Bitcoin Pro and their YouTube channel. And this is the absolute perfect timing to have him on, because we've just had the highest weekly close in Bitcoin's history. So Matt, I got to ask you right off the bat, how is everything looking on chain and where do you think we're going this cycle?
Hey, Brandon, first and foremost, thank you very much for having me. That's quite the introduction. I feel like I've got some high levels to reach today, but just going straight out there, things look great. I mean, who doesn't love to see Bitcoin above 100K? Looking like we could potentially be testing new all-time highs in the coming days and weeks. And from a data perspective, everything's looking strong. I mean, a few weeks ago, we were kind of thinking, you know, could Bitcoin drop lower? Could Bitcoin maybe go into the $60,000 region or something? And then before you know it, bang, we jump up $30,000 in about a month's time. And to be honest, none of the data is pointing towards us being substantially overbought in the long term or anything like that. So really, I think we're just setting a solid foundation to move potentially substantially higher in the not too distant future.
Okay, well, I'm going to put you on the spot. How high is potentially high? Do you think that, this is, everybody's been saying that this cycle looks very similar to 2017. So if it looks similar to 2017, based on all the data, that means we're going to, you know, the 200,000, 300,000, 500,000 mark. And we could really start to see this thing take off. So, you know, based on previous cycles and some of the on-chain data and analytics that you're looking at, where do you kind of think we're going? Do you think that this could be the last cycle, or do you think that this thing is going to blow off the top?
So firstly, I will say, as much as predictions are great, as much as we all love saying how high Bitcoin's going to go and everything, realistically, I'm not going to say they're useless, because obviously when we look at comparisons to previous cycles, it's interesting to see investor habits and behaviors and the patterns in the data. But realistically, we're going to top out when long-term holders are selling, when retail FOMO cooks in, and the sentiment just gets overly greedy. So trying to predict when that's going to happen is difficult. It's much better to react to the data. But that's a very boring answer, so I'll try and give something a little bit more exciting. And as you said, we are looking quite similar to the 2017 cycle in terms of price action when we look at the data and investor behavior and habits, sorry. But if we had to follow 2017 exactly, I think it put Bitcoin at about $1.3 million in terms of percentage returns, which I think might be a little bit optimistic this cycle. I'm probably one of the more cautious when it comes to predictions of where we could peak. Looking at the data right now, I'd put it somewhere between $150,000, $180,000. And if we are to align with something like we've seen in the previous cycles, that could potentially occur in Q4 of this year. But realistically, if we are to follow something like the 2017 cycle or previous cycles before that, when Bitcoin gets into this euphoric, crazy zone, man, it is difficult to predict. I mean, in 2017, we crossed $10,000. We entered five-figure territory, and everyone was saying, you know, this must be close to a peak. Everything was looking overheated. Things were getting crazy. It was the absolute mania phase. And within 2 weeks, we're at $20,000. So who knows? Maybe Bitcoin this cycle continues to climb up, get a little bit crazy. Things start looking a little bit overheated at 140, 150, 160, however many thousand dollars. And then you blink, and we're at $250,000. So it's impossible to predict, but I like to have a more cautious, a more optimistic, and then a base case. I'd put the cautious one about 140, 150, base probably close to 170, 180, and then my optimistic would be somewhere around the 210, 220 region.
All right, I like it. I like it. Now, with that, right, we like we just said at the beginning, we just crossed 100K, you know, last week back again, and we had the highest weekly close that we've had in Bitcoin's history. Now, with that, you know, what is, I guess, like just psychology base wise, right? It seems like a lot of investors, at least the newbies, the new retail kind of came in around that 100K mark. And now they've been kind of waddling around being like, what the hell is going on here? I know I've gotten a lot of my normie friends hit me up telling me that they bought at 100K. Like, when is it going to get back over? Now, do you think that 100K is here to stay now? And, you know, how big of a psychological barrier do you think that this is the second time around?
Yeah, great question. And it's an interesting point, actually, because the first time we surpassed $100,000, you know, it was this big psychological level. We're going to enter six-figure territory. And just the big round number of 100,000 sounds amazing. So I think not just myself, but many people in the space were looking at Bitcoin, looking at traditional media and news outlets, thinking once we break 100K, this could be the point in which Bitcoin has no return. It just continues to exponentially increase. And then following that, we had a few months of flirting around that region. And of course, we had that drawdown, pullback, and pretty boring period of price action when we went down to about $74,000, $75,000. So now it's a weird sentiment in the space where Bitcoin being at $100,000 or even substantially higher feels normal. It feels like an inevitability. I mean, just as we broke past it a week or so ago, you know, it didn't feel like this big milestone. It's been normalized, which a few years ago just would have seemed crazy to think Bitcoin at $100,000, and everyone just acts like it's normal. But I do think it is a pretty big psychological number. I wouldn't necessarily say we're definitely going to stay above it in the coming days or weeks. There are a couple of data points that maybe point us towards us being slightly overbought in the short term, where we could maybe have a little bit of a cool off or maybe even slight retracement in price action. But as long as we kind of hold this $96,000 to $98,000 region, I think that's a big area of buy pressure that we need to be watching, then things still look very positive and very optimistic. And like you said, with new retail potentially flooding in to accumulate Bitcoin above $100,000, I mean, this is something we see every single cycle. This retail FOMO, people piling in, usually at cycle peaks. But the thing that really drives the actual price of Bitcoin, the underlying market dynamics, is just simple supply and demand economics. And what we can look at is the people that hold the most amount of Bitcoin, who have been holding it for the longest periods of time. These whales who somehow can see what's happening in the market and tend to take profit at the highs and tend to accumulate at the lows. And what we can see is right now they're sitting on their hands in anticipation of considerably higher prices in, like I said, hopefully the not too distant future. So really, even if we are seeing some retail starting coming back into the space, this is probably just the start of something, you know, much more longer that can probably last throughout most of 2025, if not potentially even longer into 2026. I mean, this cycle has been pretty unique in that we've almost had this big euphoric move up, long period of sideways choppy consolidation, big move up. It's been unlike any other previous cycle in terms of just the market dynamics and movements of price action, which might be a bit boring and might be a bit frustrating to see these like big step ups. But realistically, it's probably a lot more healthy and sustainable to see this kind of thing. Just from an investor sentiment perspective, if you saw Bitcoin at, you know, $10,000, we're going back a few cycles here, and then a couple of weeks later at $20,000, you might not feel like you're getting too much value for money. Whereas if you're seeing Bitcoin at the same price it was 3 months ago, maybe you start more aggressively accumulating, and everyone kind of sets that as a fair value or a foundational price for Bitcoin. And that can kind of really set the stage for these big exponential moves higher. So it is interesting to see the market dynamics, and is interesting to see and just imagine how things might play out when the retail FOMO really does kick off, when we see people in the news talking about Bitcoin going to $120,000, $150,000, hitting new all-time highs, people taking screenshots on their exchange accounts showing how much profit they've got but don't actually take any profit, and just looking at what color Lambo they can get next. It can get crazy. And like I said, Bitcoin in 2017 doubled in a matter of weeks. Who knows how crazy it can get when retail really does start flooding back in, alongside institutional capital also flooding into the market, something we've never really seen before.
Self-custody can be a daunting task. That's why I've partnered with Bitbox. They have the best hardware wallet. They make it the easiest to put Bitcoin in self-custody. So go to bitbox.swiss/greencandle today and use promo code greencandle, and you can get 5% off your entire order. They make it so easy, all in one. You could get the hardware wallet, you could get their punch plates, you could do it all right there on that website to make the self-custody experience the easiest it can be. So visit bitbox.swiss/greencandle. Use promo code GreenCandle, get 5% off your entire order, and get your Bitcoin off an exchange into self-custody today. All right, enough for me. Let's get back to the show. Yeah, that's where I want to dive into next. I mean, you mentioned that there's some interesting data points, and I'm sure we'll get into that here in a second. But the institution, I think, is like kind of the unique aspect, right? I mean, literally every single Monday since I don't even know when, we've had Michael Saylor and Strategy buying more Bitcoin. We've had Semler Scientific, and now we're having other giant corporations. We got Coinbase now in the S&P 500 as well. So we've got a lot of big changes in just overall market dynamics. And the institutional holders are going to be a little bit different here, right? Because you're describing the whales. They essentially hold and, you know, buy at the top, sell at the bottom. The reverse. They sell at the top, buy at the bottom. They seemingly move the markets in that sense. Well, now we're going to have potentially nation states and institutions where I don't feel like these guys are really trading. You know, they're maybe going to try to find other ways to borrow against their Bitcoin or do something along those lines. So I feel like the movements from the whales, there's going to be one new whales coming in, and these hands are going to be more diamond than the current whales that we have, because those were just retail. Now, what kind of factors do you think that is going to play here? Do you think that's going to be a big giant mover, or do you even think that a lot of these institutions are going to be able to catch up to the whales that maybe got in, you know, 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think this can actually tie back to a point you mentioned previously about Bitcoin and its cycles. Is this the last cycle? I do think now that we're seeing institutions coming in, all of the BTC they're buying might not ever hit the open market again. You know, these whales who bought Bitcoin at a few dollars or a few $100, you know, they probably made a few million right now. No one can blame them for taking out some profit, buying a house, doing whatever they want with it. But all of these big institutions, all of these big investment funds, they're not really looking at Bitcoin as an investment product just to immediately make a small amount of profit. They're probably changing their sentiment and view on Bitcoin to maybe include as part of a portfolio and something that they can suggest to their clients to say, you know, previously it was 60-40 equities, bonds. Maybe now we need to have a 5% allocation to Bitcoin there. And a lot of this, like I said, is Bitcoin that might not ever hit the open market again. So the traditional four-year cycle we've seen in Bitcoin may be coming to an end in the fact that we're not going to see this big halving-driven 1 to 2 years of big exponential price action, year-long bear market, and this transitionary period in between. Maybe now we see something where we're aligning a little bit more with equities. I mean, we'd all like to see a Bitcoin decoupling where we can just move as a free and independent asset. But in terms of how it's actually going to impact the price action, I don't think we're going to have these big 70, 80, 90% plus drawdowns that we've historically seen in Bitcoin. I think now Bitcoin as an asset has grown into multi-trillions of dollars, and the billions of dollars of inflows and outflows that we're seeing from these institutions every single day are probably going to help stabilize the market. And again, playing into what I said previously, where the price action in this cycle has been a lot more step ups rather than this just big constant exponential trend to the upside. I think that's going to continue to some extent. And rather than seeing these big bear markets where it's just constantly grinding down, maybe we have these big moves to the downside, more choppy ranging consolidation price action. And like I said, this might not be the most fun and enjoyable price action to experience, but it might limit these drawdowns to, you know, 40, 50, 60%. Because as soon as we get some discounted BTC like this, these institutions are just going to be piling in to try and accumulate some discounted BTC. And then when we get to the upside, again, they might not be looking to immediately sell. Of course, they may be hedging against their Bitcoin by using derivative products, taking loans against it, etc. Everything you mentioned previously. So, of course, we are going to see these boom bust cycles like we've always seen, not just in Bitcoin, but in all asset classes in general. But essentially, I think we are going to see some slight less volatility going forward, maybe diminishing returns, extended lengthening cycles. But we do have to take into account that even though the institutions are undoubtedly having a huge impact, and Saylor buying tens of thousands of Bitcoin every single week is, of course, changing the supply and demand economics of Bitcoin. At the minute, it's still only about 8% of the supply that's actually held by Saylor, institutions, nations, etc. A vast, vast majority of Bitcoin is still being held by retail like me and you and all the audience watching today, probably. So I still think that this cycle is going to play out somewhat similarly to the previous cycles. But potentially going forward, we need to analyze Bitcoin maybe from multiple different perspectives rather than just focusing on on-chain data. We need to take into account the macro data as well. I mean, that's something we've seen this cycle when people are looking at the S&P 500 and trade wars and tariffs. realistically, you're thinking, should this be impacting Bitcoin as much as it really should be? But given the fact that we're now very much correlated to the S&P and more risk on assets, traditional investors are going to be trading Bitcoin like a slightly more risk on high beta play of equities. So it wouldn't surprise me to see, like I said, us moving slightly different going forward. And we just need to slightly adapt and evolve our approach to the market just to make sure we're being as efficient, effective, and profitable as possible.
Now, what do you think is the reasoning for a lot of these upward swings, or like your prediction that you see? Is it going to be more of the retail or more of the ETFs? Do you think it's going to be more of the institutions, maybe nation states? What do you see as like kind of the big driver here?
So, I mean, if we are to see something like a Bitcoin strategic reserve, and we see 1 million Bitcoin accumulated by the US and other nations are looking to accumulate Bitcoin through strategic reserves, at that point, all bets are off. I mean, the supply and demand economics change entirely when we get this rush in, this FOMO, not just from retail like we've historically seen, but by countries and big institutions and potentially other companies like Strategy. I know there's 21 now by Jack Mallers who are potentially going to be accumulating, again, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Bitcoin that we may never ever see again. And at that point, just the supply and demand economics of Bitcoin changes so substantially that it's hard to really limit our upside potential. If we're looking at an asset where there's only a few percent available supply at any point, and all BTC is just being accumulated by these big institutions and funds, who knows how high we can get? came out completely wrong. Who knows how high we can go? But like I said, at the minute, we're not seeing a huge, huge, huge amount of BTC being held by these institutions. And the ultimate thing that's actually driving price is people selling. So I think this cycle, the thing that's going to really drive price higher is probably going to be ETFs, institutions, strategy, nation states accumulating. Retail FOMO, of course, is going to play an impact in that. But we are still probably going to have this big peak as we see these long-term, more experienced retail holders, these big whales, and potentially some institutions here and there just begin to take some profit on their Bitcoin. But then, like I said, this is going to change the future market dynamics because all of that Bitcoin at some point is going to be scooped up at a discount by market participants that may never want to sell that Bitcoin ever again.
You know, the interesting part about the ETFs, I've heard this recently, is that I think the perception around it is the ETFs are bad, right? We've got BlackRock, we've got all these giant institutions scooping up more Bitcoin. But if you really break it down and look at the filings from like BlackRock, for example, like 75 to 80% of the people buying these IBIT Bitcoin ETFs is actually retail. And it's really not these giant institutions. So outside of maybe a few corporations, I don't even know if we've seen giant institutional money here. And is that something, is that something that you're seeing and noticing as well, that, you know, it's not necessary when you're talking about retail, are you talking about maybe buying these ETFs and maybe not putting into that cold storage? Or how are you like differentiating between, you know, retail cold storage and retail maybe ETFs, or are you differentiating?
No, so that is a great question. And the thing is with ETFs, I know we're often referring to them as institutional investors, but like you stated, a lot of these are going to be people that are just looking at their, you know, their phone, their exchange, their investing account, and buying these through these big ETF providers, but they're probably just, you know, slightly richer retail investors. So of course, it can be a little difficult to differentiate that. But again, like I was saying previously, with these ETFs, and are these ETF Bitcoin ever going to hit the open market again? When we see the outflows from these ETFs, these may be retail investors taking some profit on their positions. But does BlackRock actually sell this Bitcoin back onto the open market again? Or does it just keep it almost as paper Bitcoin or just readily available for future investors to rebuy in? So it's hard to really completely understand how this market dynamic is going to shift and evolve going forward. But I think ultimately the thing that's going to really, like I said, drive Bitcoin's price is retail investors and institutions just buying up as much Bitcoin as they possibly can. And when we look at the investor habits of ETFs, what we can see is that, of course, they're often referred to as the smart money, sophisticated investors who are accumulating Bitcoin at a discount. I mean, I've even said in this show that once we see a bit of a retracement in the Bitcoin price action, we're going to see institutions really accumulating. But we actually see a lot of parallels between the Bitcoin ETF inflows and outflows and something like the Bitcoin funding rates, which really outlines the fact that even though these ETFs, of course, have a huge amount of capital that they can invest in the market, which is, of course, going to absolutely influence the price of Bitcoin, the actual sentiment, the psychology behind these investors, behind these institutional, retail, whatever you want to call them, through these ETFs is actually very similar to the price action behavior, investor sentiment we've seen historically, just looking at the Bitcoin funding rates, looking at everyday retail, leverage longing on exchanges, just accumulating Bitcoin, you see a huge amount of parallels and correlations. And the fact that we now have all of this ETF data readily available, it probably clarifies the market a lot more than it previously did. Of course, everyone looks to on-chain data and saying, you know, more and more people buying through ETFs, is this going to negate the impact and usefulness of the on-chain data? But realistically, if you look back to something like 2017, even the last cycle, 2020 into 2021, most people were buying Bitcoin on exchanges like Binance, Bybit, FTX. These transactions weren't necessarily shown on-chain. These transactions were being executed on exchanges. Are they real Bitcoin that's actually being transferred and transacted? Who knows, of course, when they're deposited or withdrawn, etc. But now we actually have more and more data because the ETFs have a obligation to actually provide all of this underlying data. So the fact that we can now look at on-chain data, derivative data, and ETF data, it just paints an even more full picture of what investors are currently feeling and their current bullishness or bearishness sentiment towards Bitcoin.
The best place to buy Bitcoin in the United States and Canada is the Bitcoin Well. You could go to the bitcoinwell.com/greencandle and sign up today, and they will give you wishing well tokens. They are one of the only exchanges in the United States that will give you free sats every time you buy Bitcoin. You have a chance to win 1 million sats every time you buy. You get wishing well tokens. You flip the coin down the wishing well, and you have the chance to win 1 million sats. You heard me here, folks. 1 million sats. And on top of that, they have the absolute best over-the-counter service where you can make purchases over $50,000, and they will walk you through the whole thing. They have the best rates in the United States and in Canada. And on top of that, they have the best white glove service where they will take you through those giant purchases just so you feel comfortable. You'll get it in cold storage, and it's strictly non-custodial. They are saying, we want you to experience the true power of Bitcoin, and that's self-custody. So go to the well, sign up, bitcoinwell.com/greencandle today. Enough for me, back to the show. Now, all right, now let's dive into the data. Like, what are you kind of seeing right now? Are people like scooping up at an all-time rate? Because, you know, the narrative, I think, is that it's somewhat flipped, right? We've seen, MicroStrategy kind of being buying and Bitcoin's been at a surplus, but it's, you know, at the first point now where they're starting to buy more, and we're starting to see a turnaround here. And, you know, maybe that's why we're starting to see this price action, because it seems like, you know, global liquidity is going up just everywhere but the United States right now as everybody's lowering interest rates. But, you know, what kind of things are you seeing to, I guess, justify this recent price run up? And you even mentioned a little bit earlier that you think we might see is still a little bit of a pullback. So, yeah, what do you see, I guess, here in the short term?
Yeah, sure. So if I'm able to share some charts and data we can go through. So this is the short-term holder realized price. So the realized price is looking at the average accumulation cost or cost basis of all Bitcoin on the network. What we can do is just isolate this data to look at new market participants. So the short-term holder realized price shows us that the average new Bitcoin investor has accumulated Bitcoin at an average price of around $94,000. Now, what we can see is this almost acts as a moving level of support or resistance throughout bull or bear cycles. So recently, as we actually reclaimed this level, we could see we came back, retested this as support, and that really supported the move substantially higher. But if I just zoom out and look at something like the 2017 into 2020 cycle, what we can see is as we reclaimed this, Bitcoin moves up, and every time we come down, it indicates that new investors are at break even. And this is where we potentially see some short-term capitulation, some new investors selling Bitcoin, transferring that into more experienced long-term investor hands. And that usually signifies a bounce that we see as Bitcoin rallies higher. And then it's the opposite through bear cycles. As Bitcoin rallies, touches the short-term holder realized price, it usually acts as a level of resistance. New investors finally get some relief, finally say, you know what, maybe this wasn't a bad time to buy Bitcoin. Maybe I'm finally going to see some profit. And usually that point is the worst time to do it. But the thing we actually see with on-chain data is, unfortunately, most investors are wrong most of the time. But now that we've actually reclaimed this level, I think it provides a solid level of foundational buy pressure and support for Bitcoin to move higher. It's a significant level to break above, and especially now that this is aligning with some traditional technical analysis support levels as we set the previous range lows as Bitcoin first broke above $100,000 at about $90,000-ish, 92, 93. So now this is at 94. I think there's a huge confluence of support there. So if Bitcoin is to potentially have a little bit of retracement, I could see as potentially having a huge amount of support there. And you mentioned what I discussed previously about potentially being slightly overbought in the short term. This is the active address sentiment indicator. Now you have to keep in mind, Bitcoin over the past month has increased about $30,000, something that took us 11 years to initially do when Bitcoin was first created in 2009, 2010. We didn't reach that until all the way here in 2021 for Bitcoin to first surpass $30,000. And we just made that all up in 1 week. Now, what this metric is actually looking at is the 28-day percentage change in the Bitcoin price and the 28-day change in the active addresses on the network. A good indication of if a Bitcoin move can be sustained to the upside or the downside is to see if people are actually on-chain and transacting with Bitcoin. So what we can see is when this orange line surpasses this red upper deviation band of the 28-day percentage change in active addresses, indicates that we might be slightly overbought in the short term. This move may not be able to be sustained given the fact that we're not seeing a huge amount of on-chain activity supporting this price action. So if we had to cross back beneath this, then I would potentially see Bitcoin having a slight retracement or at least a bit of a cool-off period and ranging between $105,000, $106,000, the local highs we've just set, and potentially around that short-term holder realized price around $95,000. But like I said previously, this would probably be quite healthy for Bitcoin. As soon as we get these big exponential rallies to the upside, it's when we do see some people taking some profit on their positions. And if we look at something like the spent output profit ratio, this is looking at the profitability of transactions, looking at the UTXOs or unspent transaction outputs. Now, what we can do is essentially when we see huge green spikes in this, it indicates that people are moving their Bitcoin on chain and selling for a profit. And once we see these big red spikes to the downside, it indicates that they're selling for a loss. This is capitulation and extreme greed in real time. Now, like I said previously, the unfortunate reality of most Bitcoin investors is that most are unfortunately wrong most of the time. However, we have seen a recent uptick in profitable transactions on chain, indicating that we are seeing some profit taking on the network. And if you only looked a few weeks ago as Bitcoin was bottoming out, people were actually capitulating at loss. This was a great accumulation opportunity. Once we see Bitcoin at confluence, when we see aligning with the previous all-time high, people selling at loss, negative funding rates, all of this indicating people are betting on further downside, it's probably a good time to be a contrarian and bet on further upside. But now we are seeing some slight profit taking. I don't think it's anything to be too alarmed about, but I think if we could see Bitcoin just again calm down a little bit, have a few days or a few weeks of just consolidation, allow new capital to flow back into the market, then of course this sets the stage for significantly higher prices. But given the fact, like I said, we've rallied $30,000 in such a short space of time, we can't anticipate, as much as we'd all like, we can't anticipate just continue rallying non-stop. But if we just look at something like the value days destroyed, again, this supports the idea that while we are seeing some profit taking on chain by potentially some longer term and larger Bitcoin holders, if we actually look at this as a ratio, the value days destroyed looks at the profit taking on a 30-day average compared to a 365-day average and gives us these nice heated visuals to show when a huge amount of long-term large Bitcoin holders are taking profit in their positions. This is still at very low, very healthy, very sustainable levels. Very similar to what we'd see at midpoints during previous Bitcoin bull cycles. So from a macro perspective, I'm still incredibly bullish, even though if in a short-term outlook, we might be slightly overextended to the upside.
Okay, so just slightly overextended to the upside, which means that, you know, there's a lot of potential bullish things here coming along, right? I mean, we've been hinting at, you know, retail, and you've seen that it's essentially just a little bit overbought in the short term. But let's get back to that long-term outlook, because I always think that's the most interesting thing is like, all right, well, you know, it's a little bit harder. Maybe you can tell with some of the on-chain data and get a little bit, you know, I guess more of an insight, so to speak. But, you know, with the institutions now coming on and the potential of nation states starting to buy, there's been rumors that some of these nation states have been buying in the background. Is there any on-chain data outside of, you know, maybe the rumors that Mr. 100 has been coming around that more whales are starting to come in and accumulate? Or is this all just, you know, maybe we're seeing some of the ETF, you know, ETF related wallets increase?
So it can be hard to differentiate exactly who is buying. But if we look at this chart here, what we can see is that these big market participants who are holding at least 100 BTC have begun pretty aggressively moving to the upside. So what this is doing is showing us the amount of wallets containing at least 100 Bitcoin. What we could see is only a couple of months ago, this was at somewhere around 16,000, and now it is up to over 18,000. Now, this is at least 100 Bitcoin. These could be people buying 100 Bitcoin, 1,000 Bitcoin, 10,000 Bitcoin. So we are seeing hundreds of thousands of Bitcoin being accumulated by these big market participants who are trying to accumulate huge amounts of Bitcoin. Now, we can't say if this is a nation state. We can't say if this is just an individual with some very deep pockets. What we can say is big players are very interested in Bitcoin at these prices. And I think it plays back to what I said previously. Whereas historically, we've seen these big cyclical flows in the data and price action where retail have these boom and bust, they're accumulating and distributing. Whereas now that we've had a huge amount of institutional presence enter the market, the sentiment has shifted to see Bitcoin as more of a staple asset in a portfolio. So if we are seeing nation states, investment funds trying to buy 1-3% of their portfolios in Bitcoin, this is likely going to be billions, if not trillions of dollars of capital flowing into the Bitcoin market, which would just be incredibly bullish for the Bitcoin price action. And something you mentioned previously, why are institutions so interested in Bitcoin? Well, we only need to look to the global M2 chart here to show that the purchasing power of US dollars is just diminishing. Everyone knows this. The inflationary rate is just eating away at everyone's purchasing power. And the global M2 chart is just moving up exponentially to the upside, even if we've not seen a huge amount of printing from the US yet. What we can do is just zoom in here and see we almost have a one-to-one correlation with global M2, maybe with a few weeks offset. We'll get into that potentially a little bit later. But once this is contracting, we're showing a huge amount of fiat supply actually contracting, decreasing, the supply isn't increasing. What we can see is when the money printers are going and we're seeing a huge expansion in global money supplies, this is typically aligned with Bitcoin moving exponentially to the upside. And if we look at a year-on-year basis rather than just an outright basis, this shows us the acceleration or deceleration in that M2 supply increasing or decreasing rather than just the blanket rate, which tends to trend to the upside regardless of what's happening. And I think Bitcoin is likely going to follow more of this liquidity, more of this business economic cycle going forward, rather than driven by the halving events and just typical retail psychology like we've historically seen. Playing on to what I said previously about Bitcoin potentially moving away from the four-year cycles. But ultimately, I think that this institutional investment is, again, a very positive thing for Bitcoin, at least in the short term, to increase the price of Bitcoin. We've already seen they've accumulated over 1 million BTC in such a short space of time. And this is inevitably going to have a very positive impact on the Bitcoin price action, with hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars flowing into the market every day. At some point, there's just not enough Bitcoin to go around.
Now, with that, right, you're talking about the global M2 money supply, and I want to dive into that a little bit more because, you know, we've had a little bit of an interesting dynamic here with Trump and Powell. Trump is essentially, you know, chomping at the bit to cut these interest rates, where Powell is trying to keep them, you know, extremely high. I think if I always like to look at the CME group, and if you look at their percentage, I think they have like an 8% chance that we're going to cut at the next meeting. So extremely low, right? More likely than not that we're not going to cut. Now, when the U.S. does decide to cut, because we all know that that's coming, you know, how do you see this playing out? Do you see this as something as like a 2020? Because, you know, everybody's, I guess, the narrative right now is it's looking closer to 2017 opposed to the 2020 cycle. Now, what are the differences between those two cycles? And why do people think that it looks more like 2017 than 2020?
So 2017 looks more like 2020 just from the way that the data is actually moving. So if we look at something like the MVRVZ score, this is looking at the realized price or realized cap, something we mentioned previously, and the ratio of that compared to the underlying price or market cap of Bitcoin. And we can see a huge amount of correlation between these two data points, just again, indicating that investor psychology is very similar to what we saw in 2017. Now, 2020 was a pretty peculiar cycle. Like you said, we had this huge amount of stimulus coming into the market, a huge amount of capital flowing in the form of monetary stimulus, and the M2 supply absolutely rapidly increasing following the COVID 2020 dump. So the 2020-2021 cycle was pretty difficult to really gauge. And a lot of on-chain data points maybe signaled that the first peak we had at around $62,000, $63,000, $64,000 was the actual peak. And this double peak cycle was more influenced by debt and leverage and M2 supply actually just coming in and potentially propping up asset prices, maybe higher than they fundamentally should have been. Of course, this might not be as sustainable and healthy for economies and great in the long term, but realistically, in the short term, if we are to see more quantitative easing, if we are to see a pivot in the US, that's almost certainly going to have a huge positive impact on the price in the short term. Investors are irrational. As soon as we see a little bit of positive news, as soon as we see a pivot, everyone's likely going to pile in, say this is the time to go risk on. All sentiment is bullish. And at that point, of course, Bitcoin is likely going to perform exceptionally well. Recently, we've seen gold doing very well because we're in a period of uncertainty. A lot of investors are potentially a bit wary, just potentially being a little bit more defensive with their investments. But this, of course, rotates and transitions and trickles down. As soon as we start seeing more and more capital coming into the markets, that's eventually going to trickle down into Bitcoin. But like you said, looking at the global M2 supply isn't really reflecting what we're seeing in the US. Bitcoin is a global asset. We're seeing China, Europe, other huge regions begin aggressively printing, and their currencies are very much being debased. Now, what we can see is the correlation between Bitcoin and Chinese equities, for example, or the supply of M2 throughout Europe. Again, these are very strongly correlated. Bitcoin isn't just relying on the US economy and isn't just relying on one person's decision to increase, cut, or raise rates. So I think Bitcoin is very much best looked at just completely from an unbiased, data-driven approach. There's been so many people who've been saying, you know, we're going to have this big global recession, we're going to have this huge drawdown in US equities, we're going to have the economy just absolutely collapsing. Realistically, these are just people, again, predicting rather than just reacting to what the data is telling us. And especially if you try and work in probabilities, of course, at any point, Bitcoin could have this big drawn out bear cycle. We may have already peaked. You need to factor in that that is a probability. But looking at the data, we can be fairly certain that the odds are in our favor to just take a bet on there being more upside than downside over the coming months.
My favorite thing about Bitcoin is meeting Bitcoiners in person. That's why I'm so excited to tell you guys about what is going on June 14th down in beautiful Tampa Bay, Florida. That's the Sound Money Soiree paired with Bitcoin Day. They're bringing a full day of great talks with amazing speakers like your boy here. And we're topping it off with a black tie event just for you and bring in that hot lady friend. We had Bitcoin cross 100K. We're all getting girlfriends, folks. So come on down to beautiful Tampa, Florida. And if you use the link below, you will get 10% off your entire order, whether you want to go to just the black tie event or black tie event plus Bitcoin Day, you'll get 10% off using the links below. Also, if you're thinking about going to BitBlock Boom in April, if you're going to Vegas in May, or if you're thinking about going to Prague in June, use my promo code GreenCandle for all of those. You'll get 10% off your entire order. And come bug me. I hope to see you guys very soon at one of these great in-person events. Enough from me. Back to the show.
Now, yeah, with that, right, that the M2 money supply, I think, is kind of unique, right? Because we have kind of lined out this cycle where it looks very bullish, you know, comparatively, where we've had somewhat of shaky economics underneath the hood, right? I mean, if you look at the United States, for example, the consumer doesn't look to be extremely healthy. We still have a decent amount of inflation. So it seems like the big print, as Lawrence Lepard puts it, is almost inevitable. So would this just, you know, accelerate the bull run even more, where we could even see something blow off the top? Or is that something that's maybe unhealthy for Bitcoin in the short term because of how much, you know, stimulus we saw in 2020, where, you know, it just brings it more into, I guess, weaker hands. And that's where we'll still kind of see the market cycles. And, you know, the thought that this 4-year cycle and the volatility going down is, you know, I guess in the short term, it's going to be, I guess, incorrect.
Yeah, I think a common misconception that a lot of people have is that the stock market equity prices are correlated 100% to the underlying strength and health of an economy. All we need to look towards is 2020, when everyone was told to stay indoors, production would stop, a huge amount of people were just laid off, working from home, doing whatever, and asset prices absolutely skyrocketed. Now, everyone being shut down for a year isn't necessarily indicative of a booming economy, yet asset prices reached new all-time highs pretty rapidly. So I think if we are to see a huge amount of M2 stimulus, a huge amount of bullish pivoting throughout the US and potentially other economies, of course, this is going to have a hugely positive impact on the Bitcoin price action, at least in the short term. Now, does this damage the potential long-term upside potential of Bitcoin? Potentially. I mean, if you look at Bitcoin, rather than being priced against the US dollar, which is constantly losing purchasing power, if you look at it priced in something like gold or something like actually against the M2, the global M2 money supply, you can see that the purchasing power of Bitcoin hasn't actually surpassed substantially the previous all-time high we set in 2021, which potentially indicates that a lot of this cycle, of course, has been driven by ETFs and huge institutional capital inflows, but a huge amount has again also been driven by the debasement and loss of purchasing power throughout the US and other global currencies.
Now, okay, that's interesting, because you're saying, like, you know, basically just based on other currencies and assets, but, you know, the narrative for like a day or two there was that Bitcoin is decoupling. Now, how important do you think just that, I guess, from a psychological aspect, whether it's, you know, institutional investors starting to get in, or if, you know, maybe that narrative is completely dead? Where do you kind of see that going? And do you see, like, big money managers, the potential of saying, okay, well, that one day of decoupling is interesting, so now, you know, they're giving Bitcoin, a bigger look?
So people dislike when I say this, and I'm someone who's incredibly bullish long-term on Bitcoin, but unfortunately right now, I don't see a decoupling as a realistic possibility. However, in saying that, recently when we had this big sell-off in US equities, and Bitcoin showed considerable strength, and we had actually drawdown less than a lot of the Mag 7, that strength we saw from Bitcoin was really a precursor to how big the expansion we saw pretty much immediately following that with a $30,000 move to the upside really was. Now, are we about to see a decoupling? Potentially, potentially not. Realistically, a lot of investors who are just trying to not lose purchasing power are going to look to assets that can potentially have a 40, 50, 60, 70% drawdown as the first assets to potentially rotate out of in times of uncertainty. But like I said, I think this narrative is changing. And in one, two, three, however many cycles time, Bitcoin really could become this digital gold and fulfill the narrative as a hedge against economic uncertainty and inflation. As Bitcoin becomes an asset that more and more people are just putting into their portfolios and not seeing as something that we just need to buy and sell just for a quick buck, but it is something that is unique in its monetary policy and is something that acts completely different to every other market and asset class, then of course a decoupling seems like an inevitability. But I think this assurance and I think this confidence in Bitcoin as a standalone unique asset comes as the price increases. The number one thing that's going to bring more bullish sentiment is bullish price action. And as Bitcoin rapidly increases in price, potentially becoming comparable to something like gold, then investors aren't going to look to it as the number one asset that we need to actually sell and rotate out of in times of uncertainty. And like I said previously, with this institutional investment, I do see that we are going to have these bear cycles that aren't going to be as aggressive, aren't going to be as steep and declining and just horrible to live through, where we have these 70, 80, 90% drawdowns. If we have these 40, 50% bear cycles, slowly but surely, more and more people are going to grow confident, grow more assured in Bitcoin. And as well as that, it's a slightly morbid thought. But if you look to older generations who are potentially looking to assets to invest their portfolio, their pension pots into and that type of thing, a lot of the older generation doesn't really get Bitcoin, doesn't really get tech, doesn't really get everything that this is about, and doesn't maybe understand the actual underlying damage that US dollar debasement and just fiat currency debasement is actually doing to economies and the purchasing power of people. Whereas I think a lot of the younger generation is starting to really understand and appreciate what Bitcoin is, what it's trying to do, and what benefit it can serve by actually holding an asset like this, which has a limited supply and is one of the hardest, if not the hardest, asset available anywhere globally. So potentially in a few cycles time, when we see, as I said, slightly morbid thought, the older generation begin to pass and we see more and more capital flow into the hands of the younger generations who are looking to invest their capital into something that can hopefully preserve their purchasing power, Bitcoin is going to be one of the key things that a lot of investors are looking towards to put some money in as a defensive play rather than what it currently is, as a more of aggressive speculative risk on play.
All right. So then, you know, you bring up the older generation. They've been all about gold, right? So Bitcoin somewhat is known as digital gold, depending on who you ask, I guess, right? So how do you see the correlation between Bitcoin and gold right now?
At the minute, unfortunately, we don't have an incredibly strong correlation with gold. I can just get the data up here, so if we can share that on screen. What we can see is Bitcoin and gold don't have an inverse correlation where they move completely in opposite directions, but they definitely don't have a strong positive correlation where they move in tandem with one another. I think gold, like I said, has historically been this safe haven asset, this hedge against inflation and economic uncertainty. And something like equities has been the more risk-on speculative play, which is where Bitcoin has been incredibly correlated to. But this is just an asset which has increased by more than the market cap of Bitcoin this year alone. The gold market cap has increased by about $4 trillion in 2025, which is just about double the entire market cap of Bitcoin. So when investors are looking to Bitcoin, they can probably see that this volatility that we're experiencing is likely going to last until the asset class grows and is slightly more comparable to something like gold. Like I said previously, at the minute, Bitcoin is more of a high beta leverage risk on play to something like US equities. And what we can see here is the S&P 500 of Bitcoin correlation is incredibly strong and, if anything, increasing, becoming even more noticeable. And I do think that is going to continue at least for the next cycle or two until Bitcoin can really grow and fulfill this narrative of a digital gold, because it's almost underselling Bitcoin to say it is just an asset that will increase alongside equities and other speculative risk on assets. It misses the entire point of why Bitcoin was created and why many people like you and myself are interested and invested in Bitcoin, because it is something that we're trying to use and leverage to actually increase our economic freedom rather than just, you know, being tied to the traditional means of investing. So I think we're still some ways away from really fulfilling that digital gold narrative, but I do think it is inevitable, but it probably requires Bitcoin to reduce its volatility, increase its market cap, and just have a more sentiment shift and confidence growing in the asset.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because we're sitting at the fifth or sixth largest asset now by market cap. So how long do you think until we get to that narrative? Do we need to be essentially competing with gold at that level in order for us to start to see Bitcoin fulfill that digital gold narrative?
I think we at least need to increase to maybe a $10 trillion market cap. I mean, this is more speculation. This is more personal opinion. I like to just base all of my decisions on what the data is telling me, what the facts are telling me. So now we're getting into more hypothetical situations. I don't know the answer. Nobody knows the answer to this. Anyone who does say Bitcoin is going to become this digital gold and fulfill this hedge narrative at X market cap, they have no idea. No one really has any idea what's going on. But I will say it's probably going to take a couple cycles, like I said, where people see Bitcoin not being this asset that decreases 70, 80, 90%, that decreases by only 30, 40%. At that point, people have to take Bitcoin seriously. And especially companies, institutional investors, retail through ETFs, if they look at a company like Strategy, who have been aggressively accumulating Bitcoin, and they can see the benefits in that, they see the share price, the stock price absolutely skyrocketing, and they just see the strategy that they're implementing to accumulate as much Bitcoin as possible, it's going to be really difficult for institutions, pension funds, other big companies not to consider putting a small portion of their balance sheet into Bitcoin. And at that point, we've probably fulfilled the narrative and we've probably accomplished what we really wanted, to have this Bitcoin decoupling. Because who wants to be the fund manager that didn't accumulate 1% of Bitcoin when every other one did and everyone's now outperforming you? The questions are going to come back to that fund manager: why didn't you buy Bitcoin? Whereas a few years ago, the narrative was, are you crazy? Why are you buying Bitcoin? And we're slowly beginning to see that shift. And it's companies like Strategy, like Metaplanet, that are really helping to change this narrative and really benefiting the space. And I think in a couple years' time, when we really see Strategy, you know, continue to fill its potential, continue to grow, continue to accumulate more and more Bitcoin, everyone has to take it seriously. Everyone has to pay attention. And like I said, at that point, other companies are going to copy it and we're going to get this big rush in. We're going to get this FOMO, but not to a level we've ever seen before, where it's not going to be retail thinking, oh, I can make a quick buck, I need to buy a few hundred dollars worth. It's going to be institutions being, I need to buy billions of dollars worth to try and accumulate as much as I can to potentially never sell, just to ensure that I'm not missing out and losing out to our competitors.
Now, okay, so that's interesting because institutions, like we said, outside of like strategy, you know, if you're looking at the ETF buying, it's only 25 to 30% of the overall ETF buying is through institutions. Now, do you think that traditional finance still is very anti-Bitcoin from what you're seeing? Because, you know, we are seeing maybe the Goldman Sachs of the world and some of these other big banks now start to get in. And it seems like just dip their toe into Bitcoin. Now, what is it going to take for them to get bigger accumulation? Or do you think that I guess what's going to come first, like the big dogs essentially try to scoop in a bunch of Bitcoin, or from what you're seeing, or just by adding to positions? Or is it going to be, you know, now it's like every single fund, it's has some sort of allocation to Bitcoin. It's just a matter of how much.
I think a big element of this is the size of Bitcoin. Like I said, the market cap being about $2 trillion. If you're BlackRock or this huge Goldman Sachs bank, you have billions, if not trillions of dollars of capital ready to allocate. And an asset that only has a market cap of $2 trillion is just going to be impacted too heavily by someone trying to buy hundreds of billions of dollars worth. They're going to impact the market so substantially that it's really difficult to actually accumulate that much BTC without massively changing the market dynamics of the network, without instantly everyone seeing what's going on, etc. So I think it just does require Bitcoin to grow a little bit more before institutions can realistically start accumulating Bitcoin. But like I said, if we only even see 0.1% of big investment funds, pensions, big treasury companies begin to start putting some of their capital into Bitcoin as part of their balance sheet, this is going to be hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars of capital flowing into the market, which is going to exponentially increase the Bitcoin market cap. But like you said, it's kind of dipping their toes in. I think a lot of people are slightly tentative because a lot of people, again, simply might not understand Bitcoin. With a lot of the things that I do, and I actually talk with a lot of people that, you know, work with institutions, work with investment funds, work with private companies, and a lot of them are still a little tentative. They still are seeing a little bit of risk. They don't want to be the company that buys Bitcoin too late and, you know, lose their job if Bitcoin has a little bit of retracement. But this is where the strategies of the world, where the Metaplanets, where the 21 coming in, is beginning to change this narrative, because people are seeing the positive impact and influence of holding Bitcoin can actually have on a company. So at some point, it's going to be slowly, then suddenly. I think it's going to be a mad rush where everyone's slowly dipping their toes, and then we'll see an Apple, we'll see a Saudi Arabia, we'll see a Bitcoin Strategic Reserve. We'll have a big catalyst where everyone says, I can't be the one left sidelined here, because at some point it is going to be too late. But a huge part, like I said before, is just the fact that Bitcoin currently is just not an asset class of substantial size that can actually allow people to buy hundreds of billions of dollars of it without massively impacting the underlying price and market cap of Bitcoin. I mean, if the US tried to buy 1 million Bitcoin, like I said, all bets are off. All of the data is just going to break, because how do you even accumulate 1 million Bitcoin? There's just not that much Bitcoin readily available unless you're willing to pay substantially higher prices. And who wants to accumulate Bitcoin, you know, 1 million Bitcoin in one huge go and potentially have to pay $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 by the time you've actually accumulated, when you can just slowly start to accumulate, slowly start to drip feed in dollar cost average, and just accumulate Bitcoin a little bit more strategically.
Okay, so you've discovered Bitcoin and are on the path to financial self-sovereignty, but simply holding Bitcoin is not enough. You need to make sure that it's scored properly and you are in 100% control over all your assets. So sharing your keys with third parties and taking on that counterparty risk is not the answer. The answer is pure and simple. It's uncompromising self-custody, and there's no better way to do it than the Bitcoin way. They've got over 25 years of cybersecurity experience, and their team of experts can help you properly self-custody your Bitcoin, secure your digital life, configure your privacy phones, and even establish a Plan B residency if you're looking to do so. So I'm gonna help you guys out here and give you a free consultation if you take the first step and visit thebitcoinway.com/greencandle, and you can check out the boys at The Bitcoin Way and see how they can help you become self-sovereign.
Yeah, I mean, and on top of that, Michael Saylor was trying to propose that the U.S. buys up 5 million worth of Bitcoin. So if that happens and they actually go through with the GigaChad's plan, we're going to start to see some craziness, to say the very least.
But I don't think that it's outside of the realm of possibilities with all this, just because of, you know, the ever-changing landscape that we're seeing. But you mentioned institutions, right? I want to dive into a little bit more of this because, you know, we've seen Goldman Sachs start to come in, and they're just an example that I like to use because, you know, they came in, then they literally, like, Q4 of last year, they doubled their position. They increased it, I believe, by like 20 or 30% again in Q1. So it seems like, you know, every quarter these guys just keep adding and adding and adding. And it seems like it's one of those things where it's like, hey, let's hammer our winners, which, you know, generally is kind of the mindset of, you know, these big money managers. So, you know, when they start to get in and that tentativeness, when they make that first buy, you know, how are you seeing other institutions kind of go about it? Is it maybe more like the Teslas where they bought Bitcoin a while ago and then they're just sitting on their hands? Or is it more of the Goldman Sachs approach where they're, you know, essentially buying and keep accumulating?
I think a lot of institutions, when they look at Bitcoin and actually make this decision, are looking at traditional means of valuing and fundamentally analyzing a stock or an asset or a commodity, etc. They're looking at the volatility, they're looking at the standard deviation, they're looking at Sharpe's or Tino, Kalman ratios. And at the minute, Bitcoin historically has just been too volatile. It really looks like a difficult asset to substantially allocate towards where it can have these massive swings. But given the fact that we've had this ETFs, which I think just opened the doors, not just for a huge amount of capital inflows to come in, but just a huge narrative shift, I think we are slowly beginning to see institutions, Teslas, whoever it is, begin to look at Bitcoin and take it seriously. And I think it is going to be more of a buy and continue to buy rather than something we're going to accumulate, try and sell for a quick buck. Like I said, I think a big aspect of this is companies looking at Bitcoin and rather than thinking 60-40 equity bonds, is it a 60-30-10? Is it a 60-35-5? Whatever it is, at some point, you don't want to be the one person, the one company, the one institution that isn't holding Bitcoin. And when we see companies like MicroStrategy in the NASDAQ, when we see potentially their inclusion into the S&P 500 and Coinbase, et cetera, again, it really reiterates the confidence that a lot of investors are having in Bitcoin. And just because of that, we're seeing a lot of individuals, we're seeing a huge amount of corporations actually have indirect exposure to Bitcoin through these inclusions of companies in the S&P 500, NASDAQ, other indexes. Now, if you're buying the NASDAQ, you are already getting exposure to Bitcoin. If you're buying a share, an index of the S&P 500, you're getting exposure to Bitcoin. And the more that this happens, the more it really legitimizes Bitcoin as an asset, as a commodity that everyone essentially needs to own. Then again, this is going to become something where people just look to aggressively accumulate for the long term, very unlike retail, where people have been accumulating mainly with the intention to sell for a profit.
Now, yeah, you brought up like the 60-40 portfolio and maybe the potential of adding Bitcoin to that. Now, there's always been the kind of like unique toss out there of adding, you know, Bitcoin to bonds where, you know, you can maybe have US treasuries or something like that, but have, you know, maybe 5-10% exposure to Bitcoin. Now, adding that much volume of the amount of money that's in the bond market, do you think that could be another factor as well? Or do you think like mostly, you know, maybe that's more of a long-term play and the crazy stuff that we're going to see now is more of the institutions and the nation states buying up?
Yeah, I mean, the bond market, we're talking hundreds of trillions of dollars potentially. And Saylor, Michael Saylor understands this. This is why there's Strike, Strife, lots of other products and derivatives of Strategy try and actually enter this bond market to try and capture just a small portion of this capital, which again is going to be leveraged to accumulate Bitcoin. So I don't think we necessarily need to see an immediate shift of inclusion of Bitcoin into treasury bonds or that type of thing, because already Saylor is doing a great service to Bitcoin by leveraging these products that he's offering to gain exposure to the bond market, to accumulate capital, which again is going to be used to aggressively accumulate Bitcoin. And this Bitcoin, if it's never going to be sold, benefits everyone. Again, we're back to the simple supply and demand economics. If supply is just being absolutely bought up, eaten up, that isn't available for anyone else to ever buy again, and demand even stays the same, we're going to see that positively reflected in the Bitcoin price action. But then if you take into account that we're seeing a huge demand increase for Bitcoin, and then what we're actually valuing Bitcoin in, typically the US dollar or other fiat currencies, where we're conversely seeing the supply of those increase as the demand is decreasing. We're seeing the purchasing power of what we're actually valuing Bitcoin in continuing to diminish. Again, all of these catalysts play into the benefit of Bitcoin's price ascension to who knows how high. And again, I don't think this is something that happens immediately. I think a lot of people within Bitcoin, I don't want to say get a little bit ahead of themselves, but maybe don't have the longest time frame horizon, don't have the longest kind of realistic expectations of how long these things really take to play out. If we're talking hundreds of trillions of dollars in the bond market, tens of trillions of dollars in real estate, commodities, equities, etc., if all of these is trickling into Bitcoin, of course this is going to have a huge positive influence impact, but we might be talking 5-10 years before this realistically all starts entering Bitcoin. Again, just due to the fact of Bitcoin being a relatively small asset, being a relatively young asset, all of this takes time. So of course this is positive, but I think if you're in Bitcoin for a 1-2 year horizon, you're kind of missing the point anyway. And this goes back to what we said previously about institutions already recognizing this, already accumulating Bitcoin without the intention of ever selling. So I think to sell Bitcoin with the intention of just increasing your US dollar value of, you know, your portfolio, then again, you have a little bit maybe of a short-term outlook. And I think we need to be thinking in terms of decades or multiple cycles rather than just a few months basis. I mean, the ETFs was something we'd talked about for years and years and years before it eventually passed. And then as soon as it did pass, you know, it was the most successful ETF launch of all time, 1 million Bitcoin accumulated, tens of billions of dollars flowing into the market. So when these things do happen, it's going to be great, but these things take time.
Yeah, they definitely do take time. But one thing that I think is accelerating it, you mentioned Michael Saylor, right? I mean, we've talked a little bit about it before, but we're seeing companies like 21 pop up and do the biggest launch in history to raise money and buy Bitcoin. And then literally like 3 or 4 weeks later, we have David Bailey coming on and launch Nakamoto and then do the biggest in history again. And then on top of that, you know, we have GameStop coming in, raising money, and their first buy was 6 times bigger than MicroStrategy's first buy way back when. And so I think the amount of capital coming in is substantially higher when it comes to these institutions. And the unique aspect is, you know, these companies are being very open and honest and saying, hey, we are just a Bitcoin holding company at this point. We're going to see how much money that we can raise in order to buy more Bitcoin. Now, how big of a factor do you think that this is going to come in as these institutions and more of these guys are probably going to start to take notice as to, you know, we can use a lot of the products and services that, you know, Michael Saylor has been using the traditional financial tools to buy more Bitcoin. It almost seems like shorting the old system to get into the new system. And then, you know, on top of that, we had the Kraken CEO say that he thinks 10,000 publicly traded companies are going to start to come onto it. So I think the craziness is just getting started with all of this. But do you see, you know, I guess like more of these like Bitcoin holding companies, so to speak, start to come on?
100%. And I think GameStop is a good example of this, where if you're a company that maybe isn't thriving, I know that's mean to say, but I mean, if you only have to look at strategy a few years ago, this wasn't a company that was booming and raking in hundreds of millions of net profit and, you know, growing exponentially. Companies like this, which have a lot of excess cash, but don't necessarily have a booming business model, this is a great way to actually transition and become a Bitcoin accumulation, a Bitcoin strategy treasury company. And again, it's slowly, then quickly, then suddenly. It was strategy. And now we, if you were, I don't know if you can share the chart here, but Bitcoin, the Bitcoin strategy companies that exist went from 1 to now very quickly 7 that hold 3% of all Bitcoin that will ever exist. And soon enough, I'm sure this is going to double to 14, then 28. And before you know it, every single company is going to have a discussion with their shareholders at these big board meetings to think, are we missing out by not just putting a small portion of our balance sheet into Bitcoin? And they're not looking at the Bitcoin price and thinking, ah, we can't buy because it's $106,000. Again, this comes back to the portfolio holdings. If they need to allocate 5% of their portfolio to Bitcoin, they're going to allocate 5% of their portfolio to Bitcoin, regardless of if price is 5% higher or 5% lower than it was last week. Of course, when we look at institutional investors and big companies like BlackRock, they probably are being a little bit more strategic. But it's not like Saylor is waiting for a big retracement to accumulate Bitcoin. He's buying regardless, and it's working regardless. They're making billions and billions of dollars in gains for a company that, as I said, it's mean, but realistically wasn't doing great. You only have to look a few years ago before their share price was down 90%+, and now it's up thousands of percent. If companies like GameStop can leverage this, like you said, almost shorting of the traditional system and longing of Bitcoin and this new monetary system, every other company in a similar situation has to consider this.
Yeah, and I mean, even today we had Michael Saylor buy a little over 7,000 Bitcoin with the average price of over 103,000 per coin. So, I mean, it seems like he's continuing to buy. And on top of it, I don't know if you saw the crazy breaking news here this morning, but Strategy is getting sued for potentially trying to, quote, mislead some company on their Bitcoin related strategy, which I think is absolutely crazy. But do you think that, you know, the potential of short term FUD like this, or, you know, maybe we see China ban Bitcoin mining or anything like that, is Bitcoin essentially going to get away from the potential of short term FUD really driving the market down like we saw, or and is it more correlated in the respects of just like the overall macro, or can we still get some of those you know, I guess extremely bearish Bitcoin narratives to still drive the price down, you think?
Investors are irrational. They will always be irrational. We talked about a potential Fed rate cut, and now everyone's just waiting to smash the buy button if there's a reduction in that, or potentially if there's no change, which is almost certainly going to happen, potentially see a short-term sell-off. Investors are irrational, always have been, always will be. Unfortunately, if we do see some more FUD happening, I'm sure that's going to have a negative influence on the Bitcoin price action. One interesting thing is usually during bull cycles, there's more and more good news. During bear cycles, there's more and more bad news. Price really drives sentiment. Price drives the news. I don't think it's the other way around. So, of course, if we see some FUD here, it's probably going to have a short-term negative influence on the Bitcoin price action. But it's not just Bitcoin that this is influencing. If you look at the S&P 500, it just takes a couple fake tweets from some non-verified sources to see billions, if not trillions of dollars wiped out of the equities market. This is probably more true now than ever before, just due to the growing influence of social media, the growing influence of robots and quants just trading based on immediate news and just scraping every web source available. So of course this is going to continue to have an influence, and I don't think Bitcoin is now immune, or unfortunately will ever be immune to this, because like I said, investors are creatures of irrationality.
Yeah, they always say like, oh yeah, just buy at the bottom and sell at the top, like it's easier said than done. But for some reason, it's just proven fact that if human nature is buy at the top and sell at the bottom, because that's just the way investors sort seem to rationalize this. But, you know, I know we're going a little bit off base. We're not talking about just quantifiable aspects. But, you know, obviously we've got the Bitcoin conference here coming up next week, where I believe you and I are going to at least share one pint together. And I'm putting it out there now, so you have to do it with me. But, you know, we're seeing, you know, JD Vance and a lot of these big influential people start to come onto the scene and talk about Bitcoin. Now, obviously, we've had Michael Saylor for quite some time. But, you know, the difference is that these guys have giant players. We've got Trump, you know, going over to Saudi Arabia. And you mentioned that this could essentially change everything with the cycles. Now, with these big players coming in, outside of, you know, the number go up, is there any other, you know, I guess, underlying effects that you think potentially could be negative for the Bitcoin space for these guys coming on?
Yeah, and again, this is more of a personal opinion type thing, but just from a philosophical perspective of Bitcoin, it was made to kind of escape the traditional system and become this own unique peer-to-peer electronic currency, whereas now it's kind of transitioned into a vehicle for large institutions to accumulate to potentially massively inflate their share price. Is that great for Bitcoin? In terms of a individual sovereign perspective, maybe not. Is it good for the underlying price of Bitcoin, which will make us all slightly wealthier? Probably. So it depends. I mean, I'm someone that loves Bitcoin more than anything else, incredibly bullish on it long term, and it's something I'll hold indefinitely. I mean, my entire pension is in Bitcoin and has been for a number of years now. I'll be holding this asset until I'm well into my 60s, 70s, 80s, probably until I die, and hopefully I can pass it on to someone who deserves it. But ultimately, it kind of depends. I mean, it was an inevitability, really. It was it's one of the best, if not the best, monetary invention of all time, and has benefited millions of individuals and will continue to do so. But is all of this institutional investment interest, nation state buying, good for Bitcoin fundamentally? It's up for debate. I won't go too much into how this could negatively affect things in the long term, because we could get into, you know, forks of Bitcoin and, you know, a BlackRock specific paper Bitcoin that inflates and becomes exactly what they want it to be. I don't think anything like that would succeed, but of course, at some point, these discussions are going to happen. So I won't get too much into that. We're getting, you know, probably cycles and cycles into the future here. But from a selfish perspective, it's great. From a collective perspective, it's questionable, I think.
All right. Well, Matt, you've been very generous with your time, and I'm looking forward to seeing you here next week. But why don't you tell people where they can figure out more about you and more about Bitcoin Magazine Pro and the great stuff that you guys got going on?
Yeah, for sure. I'm looking forward to having half of a non-alcoholic shandy with you in Las Vegas. I'm sure that'll be good fun. But yeah, thank you everyone for watching, listening to this. I'm Matt from Bitcoin Magazine Pro. So we provide all the data and analytics to Bitcoin Magazine, the biggest publication of Bitcoin globally, hosts all the conferences, etc. And like probably you were when you first started, I just got into this data, got into this on-chain analysis, because realistically, I wasn't very good at investing. I was the one buying the top, selling the bottom, and just being pretty poor with my Bitcoin decision-making. Whereas now we can actually cut through the noise. We can see when people are capitulating. We can see when long-term large holders are taking profitable actions on their positions. And we can just copy that. We can simplify the process substantially. And if you go to bitcoinmagazinepro.com, we have over 150 live charts available for you. So just check out, and again, not just simplify and hopefully improve your profitability and effectiveness in the market, but for me, it's just massively increasing the simplicity and reducing the amount of time I actually have to spend analyzing, researching, decoding the market. I'm not spending 12 hours a day on TradingView, drawing hundreds of lines now. I take a few data points here and there every week, and you know, it's served me pretty well for the past few years. So again, thank you very much, Brandon, for having me. Hopefully all of you can find some data points that improve your Bitcoin investing and analysis, and maybe we can do this again in the future. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, man, let's do it again in the future. And yeah, of course, looking forward to hanging out with you in Vegas. And yeah, and I'll put all that stuff in the show notes. So be sure to check out Bitcoin Magazine Pro. I started using it here recently, so it's got the green candle stamp of approval, and it's helping me out as well. So thank you, guys. Make sure you smoke that like Cheech and Chong. Hit the subscribe button. Tell a friend to tell a friend, and we'll catch you guys all at the next one. Thank you for tuning in to the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here, and you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger, where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guests. Or if you're looking for more macro-related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me. I'll see you at the next one.